In a state on the front lines of battling climate change, UNF is leading the way in studying the ocean rising all around us. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. You can download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, we've got a look at the state-of-the-art floating research lab UNF is using to study marine biology and rising seas. Get on the line now, 549-2937 to join the show. Then later, combating the silent epidemic, taking our teenagers away from us too soon, suicide. Plus, it's a special treat later in the hour. Don't miss my conversation with Antiques Roadshow star Christopher Lane. Find out why he's in town this weekend. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, in our warming world here in Florida, a coastal state surrounded by those ominously rising seas, UNF is trying to get ahead of what's happening when it comes to the realities of climate change by training a whole new generation of marine scientists. And they're doing it in a practical way. Out on the water. From studying climate change to following shark populations off our first coast, UNF students have spent years studying the ocean. And now they have a spiffy new research vessel to use for those studies. The W.T. Hogarth was christened last spring by the Florida Institute of Oceanography. On Thursday, UNF students will get to take tours of the vessel ahead of using it for research later this spring. Equipped with berths for 10 scientists, as well as wet and dry labs, satellite internet, fisheries eco-sounders, bathymetric equipment for bottom sounding, and a dynamic positioning system, the Hogarth has already garnered a lot of attention for her advanced technology for use in everything from studying oil spills to red tides and lots of other environmental concerns. Now, this floating laboratory is a 78-foot, state-of-the-art, $6 million research vessel that was funded through a statewide consortium, and it will also help educate other students around Florida. And it's intended to educate several generations of marine scientists. UNF's Dr. Jim Gelslider joins us now with more about the Hogarth, the oceans, and this program, and he takes your calls, too. A pleasure. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Melissa. Pleasure to be here.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about UNF's W.T. Hogarth, the research vessel that's a floating lab for UNF's marine science program, oceanography program? What are your questions about the way UNF is studying the oceans? And what are your thoughts and comments about sea level rise and Florida's vulnerability to the impacts of a warming ocean? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And you can also weigh in on our Facebook page. And so on Thursday, students will get the chance to tour the Hogarth. That's an exciting opportunity on campus, it sounds like.
It is exciting, Melissa. You know, the listeners that drive over the Main Street Bridge will be able to see the Hogarth, those of you who are walking alongside the waterfront or the riverfront.
It'll be docked right downtown.
That's right, right near the Hyatt. And as you mentioned, this is a 78-foot vessel. It's brand new, just constructed, with funding from the state legislature as well as the academic members of the Florida Institute of Oceanography. For those of the listeners who are not familiar with it, FIO is basically what we refer to as an academic support organization. So it supports the state university system, specifically in the field of ocean sciences.
Now, the Hogarth has been funded for use not only by UNF students, but other students around Florida, and it's intended to educate a whole series of generations of marine scientists. What is the purpose of the Hogarth, not just for the present, but for the future?
That's correct. So the Hogarth will serve as a floating laboratory for Florida's colleges for several decades to come. And as you mentioned, it's not just UNF, but there's overall 30 different academic members of this consortium. And every year, the FIO vessels provide a platform for research for Florida State marine scientists to conduct important studies on the sea, as well as an opportunity for students in all of the colleges to get some valuable experience, hands-on experience on board of an oceanographic vessel.
What are your students most excited about studying? We've heard a lot about how students have tagged and tracked sharks in the ocean. That's a sexy sort of project, but what else?
Well, you know, one of the real benefits, I think, of the students getting a chance to get on boats like the Hogarth is to spend time away from the shore and really test their ability to excel in the field of marine science. Most of the work that we do is coastally based, of course. We do work from the river to the seas. We focus on animals ranging from the smallest microorganisms to the largest marine predators. But it's very rare that the students actually get a chance to be on a state-of-the-art research vessel like the Hogarth, get a chance to work with some of the state-of-the-art equipment, and live essentially on the boat for anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks at a time and work together as a team.
That's exciting. Now, in addition to that, of course, we talk a lot on this program about Florida's unique vulnerability to rising oceans. How does the Hogarth study the warming ocean and impacts that are expected to flow from that to our coastal communities?
Mm-hmm. Our issue with sea level rise, of course, is both global as well as local. So we can look at this locally on the coast, of course, looking at things like tidal gauges. But vessels like the Hogarth allow us to look at this at the oceanic level, of course, getting offshore and looking at changes in temperature in relation to depth, for example, and trying to get a handle on the expansion of water that's occurring that contributes, of course, to sea level rise.
It's 549-2937 to join us, and a study out that's published actually just this morning in the publication phys.org talks about a new study led out of Stanford by a team of radar engineers and geophysical glaciologists, radar data from the Antarctic, showing that a glacier there is more unstable than previously thought and that it may be melting farther inland at a faster rate than previously thought. The West Antarctic Ice Sheet, the Pine Island Glacier, I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Yes.
That is something that climate scientists around the world are watching anxiously. And if in fact it turns out that the rate of melts down there is more rapid than had been previously predicted. Worst case scenarios for our coastal communities could be dire. I don't want to sound alarmist, but how are you studying that? And how are you assessing that as an academic and as someone who has devoted your life to marine science?
So as you mentioned, this is of great concern, primarily because the contributors to sea level rise, at least the primary contributors, certainly appear to be our warming climate, as well as the loss of terrestrial water stores and the ice sheet, definitely are the biggest contributors. In addition to that, of course, we have shoreline loss and coastal development and, of course, a variety of other natural factors that in addition to this backdrop of global sea level rise, contribute to the formation of hotspots of sea level rise. And our area is certainly one of those
hotspots. The Southeast is one of the hotspots. People think of the ocean as flat, right, Doctor?
Yes.
But in effect, it's not. You need to think of it almost as being not unlike mountain ranges around the world. Isn't that right? Some areas are bumpier than others, and the Southeast is one of the bumpier parts. Is that a decent analogy?
That is. And there's other factors that would contribute to this localized hotspot. Some factors that would be more along the notion of meteorological phenomena like El Nino and interactions with ocean currents that tend to push water up on the shore during certain times. So all of that put together, we are in an area that is highly susceptible, and we need to start looking at what we can do both at the local level as well as the national level to try to deal with this.
Then what is your hope for the research that will come out of the Hogarth? What are you hoping to accomplish with this research?
Well, the Hogarth really is going to benefit Florida's ocean sciences community in a number of different ways. And this would range from studies that would be very specific on sea level rise to the loss of our coral resources and, of course, pollution. And FIO's work has been particularly important for assessing, for example, the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill and those effects. Some of the work, again, as you mentioned, to contribute to this training of this new field of or this new crop of marine scientists to come and do some of the work that hopefully allows scientists to work a little bit more closely with the community. And that's, I think, where we're trying to go with some of this work locally, to try to give people some opportunities to do something to improve their own chances to save their own houses, for example, from rising sea level.
Yeah, sure. I mean, what should people be thinking about long term, other than maybe not building a brand new house on the ocean? Is that a simplistic way to talk about this? What's your advice?
Well, you know, that is one of the, I guess we would say one of the more extreme options, but it is an option. Now, certainly being careful about where we develop is important, but there are some fixes, of course, that would include installation of storm drains that would allow some of the water to, of course, not penetrate the house, but
yeah,
to disperse underneath. UNF works, both my program, the Coastal Biology Program, works very closely with our Coastal Engineering Program, which is very focused on trying to identify what the impact of a number of factors are on shoreline loss, which would include, of course, sea level rise, as well as even things like boat wakes, and trying to come up with some natural ways that we can reduce the impact to some of the coastal habitat. So really, we can look at this at both the local ways, as well as even things like trying to get the state to make it easier for people to get flood insurance.
Sure. And after Hurricane Irma, certainly there will be a clamor for that, won't there?
Absolutely. I think we all saw this past year what the impacts of our rising seas can have, specifically here in Duval County.
Now, the Hogarth, as you said, will be docked along the Main Street Bridge this week?
It will. It'll be docked right near the Hyatts, and we at UNF will be running tours to bring our students to get a chance to walk through the boat, and as well as faculty members and those other people who might be interested in the boat.
Can the public step aboard?
I believe that the public can at least come by and see the boat. There will be some of the crew from the boat that are accessible, and I'm sure would be very willing to give members of the public an opportunity to see the vessel.
This is on Thursday.
This is on Thursday, yes. The boat will be there from Wednesday evening until Thursday evening.
And let's go to lots of calls out there right now as we talk about UNF's Oceanography and Marine Science Program, their floating lab, the Hogarth. UNF's Dr. Jim Gelsleiter, 549-2937. Rick is on the west side. Hi, Rick. Good morning. Hey, Rick, are you there? All right, Rick, give us a call back. 549-2937 to join the show. George out at Mayport is with us. Hey, George, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you. I was wondering, are you doing any partnerships with Mayport Middle and their marine sciences program?
Oh, thanks for that question. Yeah, Mayport Middle School has a marine sciences program.
Yes, that's true. So our program has partnered with Mayport Middle in the past. We have run summer camps. I hope to see that happen again. We try to work definitely with all of the local schools, particularly those like Mayport that have a focus on marine science, and we're always welcome to establish new partnerships. And this is a kind of an exciting time that we've really started to increase our activity in that realm. So definitely if any folks are out there that want to work with the Coastal Marine Biology Program, just definitely give us a call at UNF.
Yeah. Do they need to just search you at unf.edu?
Yes, it's pretty easy to find us on the web under the biology program. There is a UNF Coastal webpage, and it's pretty easy to contact us by just contacting us at coastalbiology@unf.edu.
All right, let's go back now to Rick on the west side. Hey, Rick, thanks for calling back. Go ahead.
I was going to comment and perhaps ask your guest to comment on the irony that the state university system is funding this research. I don't know who it ultimately will go to or anything like that. But at the same time, at a state and even a federal level, the regulators or the legislators are preventing people from using the word climate change or the word global warming, sea level rise, vulnerable populations, and stuff like this. I just find it, that at the policy level, science is completely ignored, regardless of what they're doing downstream. So that's it.
Okay. What about that dichotomy in this state, Professor?
Well, I do think this is, as the listener had mentioned, a very challenging issue, because these are real issues. And I believe even some of our politicians have certainly raised this issue about sea level rise. I know recently within the state, we've got concerns about oil drilling offshore. And these are very significant threats to the state of Florida, with the longest coastline in the mainland of the United States. But they are very hot topics, I guess, within the politics. And I don't really have much comment to say with that, just because it's, unfortunately, I spend most of my time really focusing on the science side of it. But it is very depressing, I think, as a scientist, to fight somewhat of an uphill battle, to spend most of your time developing projects that are scientifically legitimate and have very good rationale for studying. But at the same time, trying to justify that.
It's frustrating to devote your life to science and see so many people reject the scientific method.
Absolutely.
Right? Well, for our part here at WJCT, we will continue to put our chips down on science. So let's just say that. Let's go to Gil in San Marco. Hello, Gil. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Melissa. I was thinking about, I was reading Finding Florida, and they were saying that Florida is on a limestone base, and that one of the problems with that is that because it's relatively porous, that there would be a lot of saltwater intrusion if the sea level rises. And on top of that, the brackish water that comes in will threaten the aquifers that we need in order to drink. So, I'm old enough to remember when we drank water out of the tap. Now people are drinking it out of bottles, and the bottom line is even that is being threatened by this brackish water intrusion.
Right. Thanks for that, Gil. That's when you think about this issue, people might not think through all of the related problems that go along with it, and that's one of them.
Absolutely. This is a very multifaceted problem, and the listener really did pinpoint something that is kind of a side issue that's, mm-hmm. of course, related to the greater issue of sea level rise. And again, science really connects, connects is not the best word, but it impacts us at so many different levels that it's very difficult to overlook some of these issues as they're occurring. And I think we all need to become a bit more scientifically literate, and certainly ocean literate, so to speak, mm-hmm. With regards to understanding how the ocean sciences impacts us.
Do you love the ocean?
I do. I grew up very interested in sharks, and always wanted to work on sharks as a career. I have accomplished that, and now I spend most of my time just trying to look a little bit beyond the sharks, to be honest, and to look at the functioning of the ocean and what we can do in order to improve its quality, since it impacts us so greatly.
Lots of emails and tweets. Javon emails us, if we are to have any chance at slowing sea level rise, we have to clean up the atmosphere or we are doomed. Even if we stopped all emissions today, the carbon cycle takes so long that global temperatures will continue to rise. Remember the 1960s? In 69, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland burst into flames. I remember that. I lived in Ohio back then. Okay, here is another email from, let's see. Oh, there's so many. Here's one from Andy. The general consensus is that it is too late to reverse sea level rise to any significant degree. I propose we simply sit back and let it happen. Why use resources to battle something if so many people are too short-sighted to even realize that there is a problem? Let it happen. Humanity deserves whatever it gets. I'll ask you to address that in a minute, Doctor. Here's one from Julie. How can Jacksonville best accommodate its multiple riverfront development projects to minimize shoreline loss and protect those developments? That's on Twitter. Okay, let's take the first one from Andy, the listener who said, you know what, it's too late. What about that argument, that sentiment that it's too late?
Well, I do think that a number of folks have that sentiment, and I think that is a very understandable sentiment to have when you consider that if we don't start to act, and if we don't act in a more greater fashion to reduce, in particular, our warming trend, then there's very little we can do because, as I mentioned, the warming trend is really the primary contributor to sea level rise. And I don't think that we've seen the type of changes that we want to see. And I certainly understand that that's what leads to the sediment. That being said, if we do reduce or if we do try to counteract this warming trend, then we will have some impact on it. So this is, I do believe that there's some validity to the notion that this is going to happen. And it's certainly happening now. And there's probably very little we can do. But at the same time, I guess I'm not ready to give up.
And so what about Julie's question? Mm-hmm. What are concrete steps? And in fact, in South Florida, you do see municipalities taking concrete steps to protect their residents, to protect their public buildings. You're even seeing that up in this area with some historic sites as well.
Yes, we have seen that. And you mentioned South Florida, and of course, there's been new construction of seawalls and other structures in order to impede some of the movement of water and protect some locations. I think one of the things that we've been doing in our coastal land, we've recently received a gift of about 1,000 acres of salt marsh wetlands. It's situated on the eastern shore of the Intercoastal Waterway. It's located between Beach Boulevard and JTB. And within this area, we're also trying to look at the use of some natural protectants of shoreline loss, for example, oyster reef and seagrass outplants, to determine whether or not those would also be effective barriers that would allow us to protect some of the coastal communities. So we have to come up with ways at the local level, certainly, to protect our areas. We need to build smarter, and certainly we need to make sure that all these coastal communities have appropriate flood protection.
In the meantime, people could come out to the Hyatt on the North Bank in downtown Jacksonville Thursday and see your crown jewel, the W.T. Hogarth. By the way, who was W.T. Hogarth?
Oh, W.T. Hogarth is actually the former director of the Florida Institute of Oceanography.
Okay.
And prior to that, a very important individual who was also an employee of the National Institute, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. So he is a fisheries scientist and marine biologist with a very distinguished career in the field. And the vessel was named after him in honor of his many contributions to the Florida state.
Well, for the many out there who love our oceans, I'm sure this will be quite the draw. So UNS Dr. Jim Gelsleiter, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right. And much more still ahead later on the show. How you can go out to happy hour this week, raise your glass, and help the hungry of the First Coast with some very generous pours. We'll tell you all about it. But up next, preventing the silent epidemic striking American teens. More in a moment.
We've updated the WJCT app to make it even better. Stay up to date with local and national NPR news from your phone or tablet. Listen live to First Coast Connect or any of your favorite radio programs. Stay connected and informed. Download the WJCT app today. Available at the Apple App Store and Google Play.
A lot of things can happen when the lights go out.
They allowed these women for years to be abused.
For janitors, working the night shift is dangerous, even in the era of Me Too.
They need to take extra steps. They can't just wait until the next rape happens.
On the next reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 and 2017 events will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues, learn new ways to engage students, and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets today at wjct.org/teach.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, it's known in the medical community as a silent epidemic, youth depression and suicide. 11% of teens experience depression, and 1 in 5 teens considers suicide. In fact, suicide is the second leading cause of death for teenagers in the United States. Now, this Saturday, a free seminar is coming up for medical professionals to educate themselves about this problem, how to identify warning signs in teens, and how to better help young people on the First Coast who are struggling with depression and at risk of killing themselves. Allison Ventura, PhD, is assistant professor in the UF Health Department of Psychiatry. And she's here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
You know, and you tend to think of teenagers as often being depressed, but off and on. But 11% of teens really are seriously depressed. I would think that's probably a low figure.
It probably is a low figure and underrated. It's often hard to recognize the signs of depression, especially with youth. They can often mask these symptoms.
Sure. And there's this stereotype of teens as being moody. So maybe parents write it off.
That's right. So they'll say, oh, they're just moody or irritable or cranky. But
yeah,
anger and irritability is actually a sign of youth depression that's not seen in adult depression.
Well, so if you have teenagers at home, what should parents be looking for? What are red flags?
It's definitely behavioral changes. So if your youth used to be very engaged with their friends and they're not, if they're doing differently with their academic performance, if their sleep changes, appetite changes, we are looking for changes that are different.
Okay, so any sudden change in behavior. And what could precipitate a kid suddenly veering off this way into major depression?
Sure. So there's a lot of different factors that contribute. It could be situational events. It could be ongoing bullying that was never known about. It could be just having poor relationships or maybe a trauma that happened.
Maybe being sexually abused, family divorce.
That's right.
All types of things.
Correct.
And when you say this is a silent epidemic, is it because teenagers just tend to suffer silently and then suddenly they make the decision to end their lives?
Yes, it's often shocking. Parents will oftentimes say, I never knew Johnny was sad and depressed. And then all of a sudden there's a suicide attempt. And it can be very shocking because that child was acting as if things were okay, but inside they were not okay.
Isn't it true sometimes, too, that the most high-achieving kids are often the ones that do this, the ones that outwardly seem to have it all together?
Well, it varies. It can be those kids that are really, you know, they look good on the outside, functioning very well. And then it can be those children that are really struggling and they've kind of been labeled the troublemakers.
So it varies.
It does vary.
And are there differences in terms of how teenage boys and girls present and how they handle this and the types of red flags that you're looking at?
Sure. boys are more externalizing. They are more angry with their moodiness and their depression symptoms. And girls are more internalizers. They kind of hold it all within and they kind of withdraw and isolate. But we do know boys are more at risk for completing suicide.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. Boys are more likely to actually carry it out.
They're more lethal in their methods, unfortunately.
They're more likely to be successful.
That's correct.
Right?
But girl attempts and completions are more on a rise too.
Why is that?
Well, they're getting more lethal with their attempts now too, the females are.
And in what way? Slitting wrists and things like that?
It's actually suffocation, unfortunately.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's the number one reason why now it's the second leading cause of death with these youth is because more girls are attempting and the attempts are getting more lethal overall.
So medical professionals are desperately trying to get their heads around this, aren't they?
Medical professionals, but also school personnel. And we really want to make sure at our event on Saturday, this is open for anyone in the community, coaches, school teachers, administrators, but yes, medical professionals as well.
Mm-hmm. And is this also an opportunity for school personnel to talk to folks like you? Because they might not often get the chance to interact.
Absolutely. So we're going to have a lot of presentations. We're going to have role plays on how do you talk to these teens? What do you not do that's not helpful? And then have a lot of Q&A involvement.
What is something that you shouldn't do?
Well, you should not overreact, and which is really hard because there's a lot of emotionality when you hear a teen is suicidal. So you don't want to overreact and get too emotional because that will actually give the teen a message that they can't handle this. Let me back off from this.
Hmm. Of course, so many caring adults want to help, but they need this information.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a free event.
It is free. Hope for a Better Life is a nonprofit organization hosting this event. So they are making it absolutely free. There will be breakfast there. There'll be lunch there. These wonderful providers with resources for free.
And anyone who has a stake in this can register and attend.
Anybody. It could be a caregiver, a grandparent, other teens wanting to know more about it. It could be anyone in the community.
Okay. So this is coming up this Saturday.
Yes.
Basically all-day event on the UNF campus at the UNF University Center.
Yes.
People can register at hopeforabetterlife.com. It is free, but you are asked to register. Correct, Doctor?
Correct. Just so we know who we're going to be targeting and how we can maybe make our accommodations helpful for everybody.
It is a silent epidemic and the second leading cause of death for teens. So if this interests you, attend this Saturday's free seminar. And Allison Ventura with UF Health, thanks for sharing this.
Thank you very much.
Still ahead, it is a special treat for Antiques Roadshow fans. PBS star and appraiser Christopher Lane joins the show. Find out why he is in town this week. But up next, raising a glass to generous pours in Jacksonville. We'll tell you about that in a moment.
Snap judgment means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment.
Snap Judgment.
Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Wouldn't it be nice to know what's in the local daily newspaper, even if you have blindness or diminishing eyesight? WJCT's radio reading service can help. You'll hear what's in the Florida Times Union every day, articles, op-eds, obituaries, even the comics. Sign up at wjct.org/radio reading. Our thanks to Florida Eye Specialists, Delta Gamma of UNF, and the Radio Reading Service volunteer readers for giving voice to the printed word.
Do you alphabetize your spice rack? Do you solve crossword puzzles in pen? Then you will love NPR's Ask Me Another, an entire hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia.
Sundays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/hd.
Welcome back. Well, this Thursday's happy hour at Candy Apple Cafe in downtown Jacksonville will feature some very generous pours. That sounds pretty good. In fact, Generous Pours is the name of a citywide campaign to help the less fortunate in this area. Now, if you come out to Candy Apple this Thursday at happy hour, 10% of every cocktail you buy goes to support Feeding Northeast Florida. The creator of Generous Pours, Ellen Cottrell, is here with more. She's also, of course, the proprietor at Hobnob Food and Social Exchange. Hey, Ellen, good morning.
Good morning. I need to correct one thing, first of all. The Generous Pours event this week is actually at Hobnob in our gallery space.
I'm sorry. I thought it was at Candy Apple.
Sorry, the Candy Apple one is going to be in February.
Oh, my goodness. That's our mistake.
Okay. So Friday, it's usually a cocktail party. Cocktails or at a coffee house. We're doing something a little different this week. I'll just let you know before we get into the whole description of it. On a Friday night this week, we're going to be having an art exhibit and cocktail party at Hobnob.
Gotcha. Okay.
Sorry.
Cool. Yeah. Too many moving parts on some mornings. So you created this a few years ago with the idea that to combine fun and partying with charitable giving back.
Yeah, when we started Hobnob, I just realized that really when you have a restaurant, it gives you sort of a platform to do things that and have a voice that you may not have otherwise. And we really wanted to give back to the community. So we developed this Generous Pours where basically we take choose a different Jacksonville-based nonprofit every 2 months and support it with happy hours throughout the city. We decided to go beyond Hobnob and go citywide. And so we've invited other restaurants in where we can have bring awareness to different areas.
Yeah, you've had these at restaurants all over town, haven't you?
Yeah, so right now who's involved is Candy Apple. They will be in February. There will be a happy hour then. Moxie as well. Blue Bamboo was actually a couple weeks ago we had one. We've Taco Lou's been involved and some other restaurants are on board to be involved in the future as well.
How generous are the pours?
Well, honestly, the pours are the same as they always are, but it's the money that's the generous
part. That's right.
10% of the cocktails or any of the drinks that are at these events will go towards the nonprofit. This week is exciting because it's also an art show. So any of the art from artist Lori Taylor will be also donated this week as well.
Now, Hobnob is in Unity Plaza. Mm-hmm. And of course, you recently spoke to WJCT about the fact that you are converting your restaurant in Brooklyn from a daily restaurant to an event space.
Correct.
In mm-hmm. fact, there's only one restaurant still there. That development has not lived up to the expectations the development company billed when they opened their doors a few years ago. They promised a lot to the community in terms of daily events. As you expressed, the rent there is very high and the programming of daily events really didn't come about as was promised to you and the other tenants, correct?
Yeah, this is very correct. We went into that space thinking that it was going to be, the Central Park of Jacksonville. And I think as pretty much most people in the Jacksonville community know that that has not happened. The developers sort of dropped the ball and kind of left us hanging. And it's really been an uphill climb for sure.
Right. And so that's been certainly frustrating and challenging for you as a business owner. But the good news is that the community seems to have responded by reaching out and making an effort to book their events at your business, Hobnob.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I think all of the support that I've gotten through emails and Facebook have just said, you did a great job. You did all you could do in that situation. And I think since we've done that, we've gotten a lot of calls for events. And it's a great place for events. I know that you had your birthday there. It's just a great venue, great parking for that kind of thing. So perhaps this is just the way that we can be successful in that venue. It's a, you know, I'm proud of the restaurant. It's a beautiful restaurant. So if we can use it this way, then that's great.
How'd you get into the restaurant business?
Oh, Melissa, that's a long story.
We have five more minutes.
Well, you know, it's my husband's kind of always been my husband's dream. And
really?
He did a culinary certificate program in college, and he's been in and out of the restaurant business in different ways for years.
Okay.
When I lived in Philadelphia, I helped start a coffee house years ago. Uh-huh. So we had part ownership in a Dick's Wings years ago, and of course Candy Apple a couple years ago. So this was the first one where this was our dream, our vision. Yeah. Our design, everything. So it's definitely bittersweet. It's heartbreaking, you know,
sure.
When we had to close. But I, you know, if we can use the location and everything we put into it in this other way, then that will be rewarding.
Right. And it is really exciting to see that you are using this space to, and remind me who the nonprofit beneficiary is Friday.
Yep. So for January and February, it's Feeding Northeast Florida.
Feeding Northeast mm-hmm. Florida.
Yeah.
And of course, Feeding Northeast Florida is the local chapter of Feeding America, the biggest food bank in the country. And, you know, Feeding Northeast Florida serves, I think it's something like 17 counties across this entire region of the state. They are just a massive food bank, feeding the hungry and the food insecure in this community. And there are so many people who qualify as food insecure. And as a restaurateur, you care a lot about food. And
exactly.
There are so many people in this community, Ellen, as you know, who have to make decisions every week. Are they going to put food on the table for their children, or are they going to buy medication? Are they going to buy milk and chicken, or are they going to fix a broken down car? They can't do both.
Right. It's hard.
That's food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So if people come out to your event and they buy a drink, they're helping families like that. These are working families. These are families who work. They're not freeloading families.
Right.
They are working families who cannot afford food.
Right.
You know, so, you know, my hat is off to you for doing this, because you're trying to use your business to help these working poor families.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, every little bit helps. Obviously, 10% of one drink is not a lot, but, you know, 10% of a lot of drinks and at all these different happy hours, and 10% of any artwork that you buy that night is great. And, you know, after the holidays and the cold weather and Irma, it's, I know that they need that. They need some money to help with things.
I think Hurricane Irma is sort of an underestimated event that has really devastated people even more than we realize.
Devastated, yeah.
Economically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, and I when I read certain things that happened just in our community, you know, 5 minutes from where I live, I was shocked. Really shocked.
Yeah, I mean, you drive downtown any day of the week past all of the missions and mm-hmm. shelters, and you will see the long lines of people waiting to get a meal,
mm-hmm.
So with all of that said, come on out Friday to Hobnob, 5 o'clock, happy hour time?
Because this one's a little different, this one's going to be 6 to 8.
Eight.
All the other happy hours that we'll have are usually 5 to 8, but
all
this
right.
one is 6 o'clock.
Come on to Hobnob, 6 o'clock Friday for generous pours. And have a drink and benefit Feeding Northeast Florida. It's the easiest way you can think of to help those food insecure families out there. And there are thousands of them. Ellen Cottrell, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And if you're a fan of Antiques Roadshow on PBS, right here at WJCT Television, keep listening, because Christopher Lane, star appraiser, is up next.
The Me Too movement is reaching the military with a high-profile male ally. Retired Colonel Scott Jensen fought misogyny during his 27 years in the Marine Corps. Now he's taking on the Pentagon from the outside, devoted to stopping sexual assault in the military. Protecting all those who protect us. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air...
There is an air of quiet death in this house.
You're not cursed, you're loved by me.
Phantom Thread is the new film starring Daniel Day-Lewis about a renowned and obsessive fashion designer and the woman who is his muse and lover. We'll talk with Paul Thomas Anderson, who wrote and directed it. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
You know how there are certain things you just remember? For us economic types, 10 years ago this week is one of them.
It's not like where were you when Kennedy was shot kind of thing. But as a historian, I can tell you that it was an extraordinary day.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How a Federal Reserve decision on interest rates helped shape the past 10 years in this economy. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Fred Hirsch, the poet pianist, and his piece dealing with the poetry of Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass.
Or sometimes when I meet people and they say, that Whitman album helped me get through a really terrible time in my life. And I'd like to think that it's, you know, humbly because of the music, but it's also it's the words.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it is a special opportunity this weekend to delve into this area's fascinating history by using maps. Yeah, maps. The Jacksonville Public Library is hosting an event called Mapping Our Past. Now, it will spotlight the library's Louis Ansbacher map collection. And to do this, they're bringing in some expert celebrity help with a PBS connection. We're pretty excited about that. Here in studio with a preview, we welcome Laura Miner. She's Special Collections Manager at the Jacksonville Public Library. Hey, Laura.
Hey.
And joining us by phone, a name PBS viewers will instantly recognize, Antiques Roadshow appraiser Christopher Lane. Hey, Christopher.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Christopher, let's start with you. Of course, you're on Antiques Roadshow all the time. You're the owner of the Philadelphia Print Shop West, and you're a print and map expert. Now, at this event at the Main Library Saturday, you're going to be talking about geographic myths of the American Southeast and the library's Louis Ansbacher map collection. What is a geographic myth?
A geographic myth is a place, you know, like a city or a river or a mountain or a kingdom that appears on a map but not on the real world.
Okay, so are there examples of that here in Jacksonville that people might learn about?
Well, in the American Southeast in general, yes, because, of course, you know, part of the problem is that in the early days of exploration, they didn't have really great means of navigation or surveying. The landscape was very difficult to judge, and they had to sometimes do their best guesses. And they would hear reports from Indians. They would misinterpret sometimes what they saw. They had theories about how the world worked. And because of that, sometimes these map makers would go to a place, they'd come back and they say, oh, right, there's this here, this there. And there are quite a number of this kind of geographic myth in the American Southeast.
Interesting. And so, of course, you're noted as a print and map expert on Antiques Roadshow. What is it about maps that fascinates you?
Well, I find a lot of people say this, but there are two types of people in the world. There are people who love maps and there are people who don't understand maps.
Okay.
And I am a map geek, and I just have always loved maps, AAA maps, modern maps, old maps. But what I really like about old maps is that old maps let us see the world as the people at the time they were made saw the world. It's not somebody today saying this is what they thought the world looked like. It's somebody at the time saying this is what the world is like. And you can learn an awful lot about our history and understand how people at the time were living their lives and understood their world. And to me, that's an incredibly fascinating thing.
All right. Now, Laura Miner, it's so exciting to have Christopher Lane of Antiques Roadshow, a print and map expert, coming to Jacksonville. And as he talks about geographic myths of the American Southeast, of course, you'll be spotlighting the Main Library's Louis Ansbacher map collection. What's in this collection?
We have over 240 antique maps and prints. The geographical focus is Florida and the Southeast in general, but the one theme, common theme of most maps is that they feature Florida.
Mm-hmm. And when people look at the maps, they just get a look at old Florida. How, as Christopher said, how people laid out Florida, what, 100, 200 years ago?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Our oldest map is from 1522.
1522.
Yes. And then I think the most recent one's 1836. So you do get a really good feel for like how much our understanding of what Florida and the rest of the world looked like has changed over the years.
What prompted the library to hold such a unique event, focusing on the map collection?
Okay, we just wanted to celebrate the map collection. The Lewis Ansbacher map collection has been at the main library since we opened in 2015, and I thought it was time that we just do something to celebrate this amazing collection.
And Christopher Lane, I'm sure you get asked questions about maps all the time, everywhere you go. Is there one map out of all the ones you've seen that was the craziest or most unique you've ever seen?
I've seen a lot of strange maps. I think the one that kind of is nearest and dearest to my heart is actually a map I saw, I think, a couple years ago on the Antiques Roadshow. It's a 1833 map of the United States where the map maker drew an image of an eagle over the United States. Huh. Because at that particular time, it was kind of shaped like an eagle, you know, with the wings and the beak and the Florida were the feet. And it's an amazing map. And very soon after that map was issued, they added other territories, which kind of killed that image. So it's kind of a one point in history where this guy had this image of the United States as an eagle. And it's a gorgeous map.
Excellent. Well, that's just a small window into such a special treat that you can be part of a free event this Saturday, January 27th, 11 a.m. at the Jacksonville Public Library, Mapping Our Past with Christopher Lane of Antiques Roadshow. Christopher, thanks. Also with us, Laura Miner, librarian and special collections manager with the public library. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, thank you, and I'm really looking forward to coming down to Jacksonville.
Yeah, we'll be happy to have you with us down here. Well, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. 1A is up next with a look at the strength of the economy and whether it's been good to you. That's coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow, and if you missed any part of this show, the rebroadcast is tonight at 8 p.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.